Manetho says again that afterward Amenophis came from Ethiopia with a great force, and his son Ramses also with his own force, and the two of them joined battle with the shepherds and the impure ones, defeated them, killed many, and pursued them to the borders of Syria. Such then, and things like these, is what Manetho wrote. That he is talking nonsense and lying openly I will show, first setting apart, for the sake of what I shall say to others later, this point. He has himself granted us and admitted that our race was not originally Egyptian, but came in from outside, conquered Egypt, and afterward left it again. That the disfigured Egyptians were not mixed in with us afterward, and that Moses, who led the people, was not one of them but had lived many generations earlier. These points I shall try to refute through his own statements. The very first cause he lays down for his fabrication is ridiculous. He says King Amenophis desired to see the gods. What gods? If he meant those legally established among them, the bull, the goat, crocodiles, and dog-headed apes, he already saw them. But how could he see the heavenly gods? And why did he have this desire at all? Because, by Zeus, an earlier king before him had seen them. So he had learned from that king what sort of beings they were, and in what manner he had seen them, so he had no need of any new device. But the seer was supposedly wise, through whom the king expected to accomplish this. And how did he not foresee in advance that his desire was impossible, for it did not turn out? And what sense did it make that because of the maimed or the leprous the gods should become invisible? For they are angered by impious acts, not by bodily defects. And how could 80,000 lepers and diseased people possibly be gathered together in almost a single day? And how did the king disobey the seer? For the seer told him to expel the disfigured from Egypt, but he instead threw them into the stone quarries, as though he needed laborers rather than intending to purify the land. He says that the seer himself, foreseeing the wrath of the gods and what would befall Egypt, killed himself, but left the prediction in writing for the king. Then, how did the seer not know from the start that he himself would die? And how did he not immediately contradict the king when he wished to see the gods? And how was it reasonable to fear evils that would not even befall him personally? Could anything worse have happened to him than what he hastened upon himself? But let us look at the silliest point of all. Having learned this and being afraid of what was to come because of those disfigured men whom he had been told to cleanse Egypt of, he still did not drive them from the land, but when they begged him, gave them a city, as Manetho says, the one once inhabited by the shepherds, called Oaris. Having gathered there, he says, they chose as their leader one of the priests who had once come from Heliopolis, and that this man taught them neither to worship the gods nor to abstain from the animals worshipped in Egypt, but to sacrifice and eat them all, and to associate with no one except those bound by the same oath, binding the multitude by oaths that they would surely abide by these laws. And having fortified Oaris, he waged war against the king. And he adds that he sent to Jerusalem, calling on those people to join him as allies and promising to give them Oaris, since it was, he claims, ancestral to those who would come from Jerusalem, from which base they would hold all Egypt. Then he says 20 myriads of them came, an army of 200,000, and that the king of the Egyptians, Amenophis, not thinking it right to fight against the gods, fled at once to Ethiopia, having left Apis and some of the other sacred animals in the care of the priests, ordered to guard them. Then the men of Jerusalem, having come, laid waste the cities, burned the temples, slaughtered the sacred animals, and in general abstained from no lawlessness or cruelty. And the priest who had established their constitution and their laws was, he says, by descent a Heliopolitan, named Osarsef after the god Osiris worshipped at Heliopolis, but he changed his name and called himself Moses. He says that in the 13th year, for that was the time destined for his exile, Amenophis came from Ethiopia with a large army, joined battle with the shepherds and the impure ones, defeated them in the fight, and killed many, pursuing them to the borders of Syria. In these details again, without realizing it, he lies implausibly. For the lepers and the multitude with them, even if they had earlier been angry with the king and those who had done these things to them, in accordance with the seer's prediction, once they had come out of the quarries and received from him a city and land, would surely have become gentler toward him. But if they still hated him, they would have plotted against him privately, not have taken up war against everyone, clearly, since they had, being so numerous, the most extensive kinship ties. Yet even had they resolved to make war on men, they would not have dared to war against their own gods, nor set laws so utterly opposed to their ancestral ones and those by which, and grew up. We should be grateful to Manetho for saying that the authors of this lawless act were not the leaders who came from Jerusalem, but the Egyptians themselves, especially their priests, who devised it and made the mob swear to it. Yet is it not absurd that none of their own relatives or friends joined the revolt or shared the risk of the war, while they sent these polluted men to Jerusalem to bring back an alliance from that quarter? What friendship or kinship had existed between them beforehand? On the contrary, they were enemies and differed most widely in their customs. He says the Egyptians at once obeyed those who promised to seize Egypt for them, as if they had no accurate knowledge of the land from which they had been driven by force. Now, if they had been in desperate or wretched straits, perhaps they might have taken such a risk. But living as they did in a prosperous city and enjoying a large territory better than Egypt, why would they have risked helping men who had long been their enemies and were maimed in body, men whom not even their own relatives could bear? They could not have foreseen the king's coming flight, for Manetho himself says the opposite, that the king's son, with 300,000 men, met them at Pelusium. This much those who arrived certainly knew, but how could they have guessed his change of heart and his flight? Then, he says that once the men from Jerusalem had gained control of Egypt, they did many terrible things, and he reproaches them for it, as though he had not himself brought enemies upon the Egyptians, or as though it were not the men summoned from outside whom one ought to blame, since the native Egyptians had already been doing these very things before their arrival, and had sworn to do them. But later Amenophis attacked, won the battle, and drove the enemy in slaughter all the way to Syria. For Egypt is altogether so easy a prey to any invader that those who then held it by force, on learning that Amenophis was alive, neither fortified the passes from Ethiopia, though they had ample resources for it, nor prepared any other force. Yet he, killing them, Manetho says, pursued them as far as Syria through the waterless sand, clearly no easy or bloodless crossing for an army. According to Manetho, then, our people are neither of Egyptian stock, nor did any of that stock mix with us. For of the lepers and the sick, it is likely that many died in the quarries, having spent a long time there in misery, many more in the battles that followed, and the greatest number in the final battle and the flight. It remains for me to speak to him about Moses. The Egyptians consider this man marvelous, even divine, yet they want to claim him as their own with an implausible slander, saying he was a Heliopolitan, one of the priests from there, driven out with the rest because of leprosy. But the records show he lived 518 years earlier, and that he led our fathers out of Egypt into the land we now inhabit. That he was not afflicted with any such bodily misfortune is clear from his own words. He forbade lepers to remain in a city or dwell in a village, but ordered them to walk alone with their garments torn, and he considered anyone who touched them or shared a roof with them unclean. Moreover, even once the disease was cured and a man had recovered his natural condition, he prescribed certain purifications, washings in spring water, and the shaving of all the hair, and commanded that many and varied sacrifices be performed before the man could enter the holy city. Yet it would have been natural for the opposite to happen, for a man who had suffered this misfortune himself to show forethought and kindness toward those who suffered the same. And he legislated this way not only concerning lepers, but he did not even allow men maimed in the smallest part of the body to serve as priests. Indeed, if a man serving as priest suffered such a misfortune while in office, he was stripped of the honor. How likely is it, then, that such a man would thoughtlessly make laws against himself, a man gathered up out of just such misfortunes, framing statutes to his own reproach and harm? Moreover, he has changed the name most implausibly. Asarsef, he says, was his name. But this does not fit the change he makes, whereas the true name reveals the man saved from the water, for the Egyptians call water Moy. I think enough has been said, and it is clear that as long as Manetho followed the ancient records, he did not stray far from the truth. But once he turned to unattested myths, he either composed them implausibly himself, or believed some who had spoken out of hostility. After him, I wish to examine Karaman, for he too, claiming to write an Egyptian history, and giving the king the same name Manetho gave him Amenophis and his son Rameses, says that in a dream Isis appeared to Amenophis, reproaching him because her temple had been razed in the war. Phrytobots, a sacred scribe, told him that if he purged Egypt of the men who carried the defilement, he would be freed from his terror. Amenophis then selected 250,000 of the afflicted and expelled them. Their leaders were Moses and Joseph, both scribes, Joseph also being a sacred scribe, and their Egyptian names were Tisithon for Moses and Pedaseph for Joseph. These men came to Pelusium, and there met 380,000 who had been left behind by Amenophis, men he had refused to bring into Egypt, and making an alliance with them, they marched against Egypt. Amenophis, unable to withstand their advance, fled into Ethiopia, leaving behind his pregnant wife, who hid in some caves and there gave birth to a son named Rameses. And when he had grown to manhood, he drove the Jews, about 200,000 of them, into Syria, and welcomed his father Amenophis back from Ethiopia. So much for Karaman. I think it is immediately obvious from what has been said that both men are lying. If there were some underlying truth, they could not possibly disagree so much, whereas men who invent falsehoods do not write in agreement with others, but each shapes his own fancies. Manetho says the beginning of the expulsion of the polluted men was the king's desire to see the gods. Karaman has invented instead a dream of Isis. Manetho says it was Amenophis who foretold to the king the means of purification. Karaman says it was Phrytobots. As for the number of the multitude, the two come very close. One says 80,000, the other 250,000. Further, Manetho first casts the polluted men into the quarries, then gives them Avaris to settle in, stirs up war between them and the rest of the Egyptians, and only then has them call in the aid of the people of Jerusalem. Karaman says that as they were leaving Egypt they found, near Pelusium, 380,000 men left behind by Amenophis and invaded Egypt again together with them, while Amenophis fled into Ethiopia. And here is the most remarkable point of all. He does not even say who these many tens of thousands of soldiers were, or where they came from, Egyptian by race or foreigners, nor does he explain why the king was unwilling to bring them into Egypt, this same king who, on his account, invented the dream of Isis about the lepers. Moreover, Karaman has added Joseph to Moses as though expelled at the same time, when in fact Joseph had died 4 generations before Moses, a span of nearly 170 years. And again, Rameses the son of Amenophis, according to Manetho, is a young man who fights alongside his father and shares his flight into Ethiopia, whereas Karaman has made him born in a cave after his father's death, and afterward, victorious in battle, driving the Jews, some 200,000 of them, into Syria. What carelessness! He never even said earlier who the 380,000 were, nor how the 23,000 who are missing perished, whether they fell in the battle or went over to Rameses. And the most astonishing thing of all, it is impossible to learn from him whom exactly he means by the Jews, or to which group he gives this name, the 250,000 lepers, or the 380,000 near Pelusium. But it would perhaps be foolish to spend more words refuting men already refuted by their own account. Refutation at the hands of others would have been more restrained. I will bring forward, in addition to these, Lysimachus, who adopted the same premise of falsehood about the lepers and the maimed as the others, but has outdone their implausibility in his inventions, clearly composing his account out of deep hostility. He says that under Bacchorus, king of the Egyptians, the people of the Jews, being leprous and scabby, and afflicted with certain other diseases, took refuge in the temples and begged for food. And since a great many people fell ill, a famine came upon Egypt. Bacchorus, king of the Egyptians, sent men to the oracle of Ammon to ask about the famine, and the god replied that the temples must be purified of unclean and impious men by casting them out of the temples into desert places, and that the scabby and leprous must be drowned, since the sun was angered at their being alive, and that once the temples were purified, the land would again bear fruit. Bacchorus, having received the oracle, summoned the priests and the temple attendants and ordered them to make a selection of the unclean, hand them over to the soldiers to be led into the desert, and bind the leprous in sheets of lead to sink them in the sea. Once the leprous and scabby had been drowned, the rest were gathered together and set out in desert places to die. But they came together and took counsel about their own fate, and when night fell they lit fires and lamps to keep watch over themselves, and fasting through the following night, they besought the gods to save them. The next day, a certain Moses advised them to risk cutting a single road straight ahead until they reached inhabited places, and he charged them to show goodwill to no one, to give not the best advice but the worst, and to overturn the temples and altars of any gods they came across. The rest agreed, and carrying out what they had resolved, they made their way through the desert, and after considerable hardship they came to inhabited country, where they abused the people, plundered and burned the temples, and came to the land now called Judea. There they founded a city and settled. This town was named Hierosilla, temple robbers, after their conduct. Later, having grown powerful, they changed the name in time to avoid the reproach, calling the city Hierosolyma and themselves Hierosolymites. This man did not even manage to name the same king as the others, but has invented a still newer name. And setting aside the dream, he has gone off instead to an Egyptian prophet at the Oracle of Ammon to fetch a response about the scabby and leprous, for he says a multitude of Jews gathered in the temples. Did he give this name to the lepers alone, or only to those Jews who fell into these diseases? For he says, the people of the Jews. What sort of people, newcomers, or native by race? Why then do you call them Jews if they were Egyptians? But if they were foreigners, why do you not say from where? How, when the king had drowned many of them in the sea and cast the rest out into desert places, could so great a multitude have been left over? Or how did they cross the desert, take control of the land we now inhabit, found a city, and build a temple renowned among all peoples? He ought also, in speaking of the lawgiver, not merely to have given his name, but to have made clear his race and lineage, and to have explained why he undertook to lay down for them such laws about the gods and about wrongdoing toward other men during their journey. For if they were Egyptian by race, they would not so readily have abandoned their ancestral customs. And if they were from elsewhere, they must surely have had laws of their own, kept through long habit. If then they had sworn never to show goodwill to those who had driven them out, that would have made reasonable sense. But that they should have declared undeclared war on the whole of mankind. If indeed they behaved as badly as he himself says, at a time when they needed help from everyone. This proves great folly, not on their part, but on the part of the liar, who has even dared to say that they named the city after their own temple robbery, and later changed it. For it is clear that to those born afterward the name brought shame and hatred, whereas the founders of the city themselves, in naming it so, supposed they were honoring themselves. This noble fellow, in his great intemperance for abuse, failed to grasp that we Jews do not use the same word for commit sacrilege that the Greeks do. What more, then, should one say against a man who lies so shamelessly? But since the book has now reached a fitting length, I will make a fresh beginning and try, in what follows, to complete the rest of what the subject requires.